Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find Here Be Monsters now at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's too much violence in the black community. So a black will die 1% or less at the hands of the police and 99% at the hands of a civilian, most often another black. So if you want to deal with this on the black side, you've got to teach your children to be respectful to the police, and you've got to teach your children that the real danger to them is not the police, the real danger to them 99 out of 100 times, 9,900 out of 1,000 times, are other black kids who are going to kill them. That's the way they're going to die.
Former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani on Face the Nation earlier this summer, making a case for why so-called black-on-black crime is the real problem for African Americans, not police violence. Coming up, how that became a conservative talking point. But first, slavery, Jim Crow, lynching, the list of injustices black people have suffered in this country is long, very long. And that's why some say they deserve reparations. Today, Georgetown University, a school that owned slaves and sold them, is taking a step towards that. University officials have decided to give descendants of those slaves applying to Georgetown preferential consideration for admission. The school is also issuing an apology and renaming some buildings, among other measures. Alfred Brophy is a law historian at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he studies property and race in colonial and antebellum America. And he's here now. Welcome to the program.
Madeline, really good to be with you.
Great to have you. First of all, what is your reaction to this decision by Georgetown?
I thought it was a really terrific document. A number of schools have studied their connections to slavery, and you know, University of Alabama, University of Virginia, William and Mary, Harvard, Yale, lots and lots of Brown University, lots of schools have done this. But what I think Georgetown, the change that Georgetown presents is trying to figure out, not just talk about the connections of the past to the present, but where to go with this going forward, right? Universities are institutions that truck in knowledge, generation, and dissemination. And so they're talking about their connections to the past, and this is the real innovation that Georgetown has. They're talking about what Georgetown can do going forward to address the legacy of slavery and segregation that followed the end of slavery in 1800.
Okay, well, briefly tell us, what is Georgetown's history with slavery?
Yeah, so Georgetown, the Jesuits, Georgetown's a Jesuit institution. The Jesuits in the from the late 1700s owned a number of, actually hundreds of human beings, and they were in Maryland working Jesuit property. In the 1830s, the Jesuits partly wanted to get rid of, end their connections to slavery, also wanted to raise money, so they sold hundreds of human beings, and many of those people ended up on plantations in Louisiana. This history has been known a little bit, but not studied closely. And recently, Georgetown connected up to descendants of these people whom the Jesuits had once owned and whose sale had promoted the development of Georgetown University. And that sort of dialogue has been going on since this spring. And this is the sort of their next step in reconciling and trying to figure out what to do next about this history.
So they've been having this conversation for a while. Why now? Why has this come about now?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think there's been increasing talk of the connections of universities to slavery. Brown University produced a huge report on this maybe back in 2006. Other schools have been sort of slowly exploring their connections. And so Georgetown is both able to sit on the shoulders of those other schools and understand talk about their connections to slavery, but then think about what's the next step. Okay, we know that universities benefited from slave labor. They taught pro-slavery doctrine, so they taught about the importance of slavery. They justified the institution. And the innovation Georgetown has is to now say, well, what's the next step? Georgetown does two things. One is they say, well, we want to bring into the university descendants of the people whom the Jesuits sold. But they also, and I think this is the most important feature, they're saying, we want to build this out, not just talk about the descendants of the hundreds of people sold by the Jesuits, but we want to think about what we as a university can do to address the legacy of slavery and segregation. Mm. And I think that's the important piece. It's not just the relatively small number of people Georgetown sold. It's what can we do to address this legacy of slavery and segregation?
Well, some would say reparations, i.e. money, mm-hmm. i.e. financial aid or scholarships or what have you. At least that's what Georgetown could do. But it's
right.
not in this case, or at least not yet.
Right. So Georgetown, I think, is trying to say we want to have a much more capacious, a broader vision of reparations than just, you know, a cash payment to some individual. That was an argument made, you know, 15 years ago to make reparations look like a ridiculous idea. So people say, well, Oprah and Michael Jordan don't need cash payments. And the serious people who've been thinking about reparations have been thinking about it in a much broader sense, you know, a renewed social welfare program, education, health care, increased job opportunities, right? Things that do not involve direct cash payments to individuals, rarely involve direct cash payments to individuals, but are community building, social safety net kinds of programs. And I think that's what Georgetown is saying. We want to be committed to using our expertise as scholars and as teachers to try and figure out where to go next to address this, you know, huge inequality that exists, right? Even Donald Trump is talking about 40% of African-American children live in poverty, and perhaps that has something to do with the legacy of slavery and segregation.
Right. Well, what about these other universities you mentioned? Harvard, Yale, Brown, et cetera.
Right. So it's great. So what they did in really good fashion was to open the dialogue and say, you know, Brown took money from this, made off the slave trade. And then over time, they became anti-slavery, but and Harvard, Yale, Columbia, Princeton, the stories are pretty similar. Southern schools, much more implicated in pro-slavery thought, also, as well as owning human beings. Washington College, now Washington and Lee University, sold about 50 people around the same time that Georgetown was doing this. But what all of those schools have talked about their history, but they haven't made the next turn to link that history to the present and to say, we want to dedicate part of our mission to trying to address and undo this legacy of slavery.
And it's part of the reason why Georgetown is doing this is because it is a Jesuit Catholic school, and they are concerned with issues of morality.
I've got to think that's the answer to that is yes. I mean, I think once again, as in the era of slavery, where the religious leaders led us towards anti-slavery, as happened during the Civil Rights Movement, where the leaders were often religious leaders. Again, religion is leading us towards increased heightened sense of morality and duties to our fellow Americans. I think it's also, though, that so we've got some great leadership at Georgetown, but I think it is also they're able to, you know, we've evolved a sense. We're now able to understand slavery is connected to segregation, which is connected to the present. So there, you know, we've evolved the scholarship, the thinking, the advocacy has evolved to the point where we can now say, okay, the next step has got to be taking some kind of concrete action, not just understanding that slavery burdens the present, but really, what can we do positive going forward?
Mm. And the Black Lives Matter movement has made reparations.
It put it back on the radar screen, right? Black Lives Matter has is a new generation of activists who've come to the stage and pointed out the ways in which, government-imposed inequality, but also just sort of system-wide inequality, it has put it into the public mind. And I think, you know, it's yet another instance in which a handful, a small number of dedicated activists have have shifted the conversation.
Alfred Brophy, law historian at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, thank you.
Enjoyed it.
And we want to hear from you. Should we be using the word reparations? Do you think the federal government should compensate the descendants of slaves monetarily? Comment on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. And we've been talking about the effect of Black activists on Georgetown's decision to admit its slaveholding past and try to do something about it. Black Lives Matter has focused the nation's attention on violence against Black people, particularly violence perpetuated by police officers. While some have pushed back, saying the real violence against African Americans is by other African Americans, so-called black-on-black crime. That term has become loaded since it was introduced back in the 1970s. And here to talk about it and the issue of crime in Black neighborhoods and what's behind it is Khalil Muhammad, professor of history, race, and public policy at Harvard. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much, Madeline, for having me.
Great to have you. Well, first of all, your reaction to what's happening at Georgetown and what you think your university, Harvard, should be doing.
Well, I think that Georgetown is definitely doing the right thing by making an affirmative amends for harms that go way back to its founding. Do they need to add a financial incentive to those descendants to come to Georgetown? Absolutely. Higher education is very expensive, and certainly private elite universities are exceptionally expensive. So there's nothing to critique in terms of the genuine effort of the president and the working group's hard work in making these recommendations and changing names on buildings. I think they can also go a step further and really tell this story in all of their promotional literature because it is their history.
Yeah.
But they're going to have to add some financial incentive to those descendants.
And at Harvard, too?
Well, at Harvard, the good thing about Harvard is the endowment allows them to offer significant financial assistance regardless mm-hmm. of the formerly the descendants of the formerly enslaved. So I think Harvard has perhaps a slightly harder road to travel precisely because of its wealth. And they have the same work to do, which is it's got to tell a different origin story, and it's going to have to be more creative with its financial resources as it pertains to addressing these issues.
Okay, let's get to black-on-black crime. That phrase, where did it come from?
Well, the first use of the phrase comes from a Chicago Defender editorial back in the early 1970s as a plea for the community to self-police and to show greater love for its residents and to really stop doing harm to itself. So that's the first use of the phrase we know of quote-unquote black-on-black crime. It was an internal dialogue meant to call attention to the violence within the community as an effort to do better for everyone. But there's a larger story and a deeper one historically, and that is that not long after the end of slavery, the concept of Black people's criminality as a fundamental reflection of their humanity disqualified them from the full fruits of their freedom, and therefore first-class citizenship should be withheld because they were a dangerous threat to society. And in the terms of that day, often liberal and conservatives would refer to Black people not as victims of Jim Crow segregation or racism, but as quote-unquote their own worst enemies. And this was the similar or equivalent language of black-on-black crime that we hear today from the right or from conservatives in particular.
So it was originally a phrase used by Black activists or people in the community who wanted to call attention to the fact that perhaps there wasn't enough policing happening in their neighborhoods. They're being ignored by the power structure, and that needed to be addressed. And now it's being embraced by people on the right, saying there's something wrong with this community.
Well, the truth is that the right did not appropriate it from the dialogue that the Black community was having with itself. I think that it's important to offer one caveat to your summary. The issue wasn't a call for more policing. In fact, that same critique of black-on-black crime that the Chicago Defender used was also a critique of abusive police officers. Mm-hmm. The issue was, how are we to respond to systemic discrimination in education, in housing, in day-to-day treatment with white people? Are we to turn on ourselves, or are we to love each other and figure out a way collectively to get past this, including police brutality? And that is something that is completely unacceptable unacknowledged and missing in the contemporary conversation when people do reach back to this story of black-on-black crime in the 1970s, as the Chicago Defender, a black weekly newspaper, articulated. The deeper story is almost unknown. So someone like Rudolph Giuliani has no idea that he sounds very similar to people of all political stripes 100 years ago who essentially said that lynch mobs may be an unfortunate reality, but they're only doing the work of protecting the community from black people who hurt themselves. That essentially you could not make a complaint about racial violence in America without pointing to black people's criminality as an excuse for discrimination, including racial terror.
Although, you know, flash forward to the modern age, and people, activists are saying that their neighborhoods are underpoliced, that they don't get the same kind of attention, that if a white person is killed in a white neighborhood, there's a lot of police attention, detectives on the case 24/7, and that doesn't necessarily happen in black neighborhoods.
Well, there is also a longstanding tradition since that 100 years ago. I've written about it. Randall Kennedy, Harvard law professor, has written about it. It is the contradiction of a community being over-policed and under-protected. And that is the problem of the presence of police officers not actually looking out for the interest of victimization, in a sense, knowing the community, making fine distinctions, or even using discernment to know who are the quote-unquote good guys and who are the bad guys, but essentially coming in with a very heavy hand and a blunt instrument of policing as a form of social control. That is the critique that Black Lives activists are making, and that is the critique of community residents who want their communities to be safer. They want police officers to show up and not shoot the victims who have called the police in the first place, which has happened many, many times over the last couple of years.
So when we're talking about homicides in cities, it's black people killing black people, white people killing white people. But we never hear white on white crimes. We never hear that phrase.
No, we don't. And in fact, there was once upon a time in America when we were more likely to hear white-on-white crime in the words of people like Jane Addams, who was a leading social worker, but it didn't lead to the conclusions we have today. It's almost axiomatic to make the connection between violence in the community and policing in prisons, when in fact, Jane Addams worked tirelessly 100 years ago in the progressive era in places like Chicago, which of course is ground zero for this conversation today, to disrupt the notion that people who are killing each other need to be punished. What she saw it as is a victim of social isolation, of xenophobia, of nativism, of racism, and wanted to rewire the system to be more compassionate, to establish social welfare programs in order to help those people so that they might be incentivized to care about the community, the society, and themselves.
Yeah, so the idea that this doesn't happen in a vacuum, that there are all sorts of forces shaping what happens.
That's right. But also, I think this is the critical link, that the violence is used to divest of the larger social forces that affect all communities. We have a drug addiction problem that is taking the lives of white Americans all over the place. And no one is talking about the pathologies of white America. They're talking about something's wrong in the water in society that is creating drug addiction. So we're calling for compassion. We're calling for all sorts of interventions to prevent heroin and prescription drug addictions. That's the difference between how things have responded to white premature death, including violence, as compared to African American.
So should we just not use that phrase, black on black crime?
We should not use that phrase, black on black crime. That is absolutely true.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Khalil Muhammad, professor of history, race, and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. Coming up, smile. You'll feel better. The origins of the idea that our facial expressions affect our emotions and how that idea has been challenged in a recent scientific study. That's next on Press Play.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for handpicked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download it for free at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Smile, even if you don't feel like it, especially if you don't feel like it, in fact, because it will make you feel better. That is classic social psychology wisdom. Fake it till you make it. Recent studies have even found that Botox can ease depression by making it harder for people to frown. But Now, a new large-scale study suggests a much more complicated link between facial expressions and emotions. Daniel Engber is a columnist and science writer for Slate. He recently wrote about this study. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, this idea of manipulating emotions by changing your facial expressions and body language goes back a long way. When did it originate?
It originates, I think, in the 19th century. It's often pinned to Charles Darwin, who wrote in 1872 that your facial expressions could intensify or attenuate the associated feelings that went with them. So if you, you know, scowled while you were angry, it would make you even more angry.
And then 100 years later or so, in 1988, there was this landmark study done on this. Tell us about that study.
So, you know, people agreed for a long time that there may be some connection between facial expressions and how you feel. The details were up for grabs. You know, it might be that if you go around forcing yourself to smile, you just kind of, you know what you're doing. You have a motivation to be happier, and you can kind of make yourself happier. But there was another idea that maybe this was happening more directly and unconsciously, that somehow just the contraction of certain facial muscles would affect blood flow to your brain, or by some other mechanism, just have this direct effect on your emotions that would change them, you know, would be the primary mover in changing how you feel. So the study was done the study began in 1985, it was published in 1988, and the idea was, what if you got people in the lab to make facial expressions without even realizing what they were doing? So the idea was to sort of trick your subjects into smiling or frowning, and then see if that changed their mood.
And did it?
Well, it did. So the technique, the now famous technique, was these researchers, Lenny Martin and Fritz Strack, they had the subjects put pens in their mouths. Either they held them in between their lips or between their teeth. And if you try that, you'll see that when you put a pen between your lips, your mouth kind of naturally goes into a bit of a frown. And if you hold the pen between your teeth, your mouth naturally forms into a kind of smile. And then they asked the people to rate how funny they thought a bunch of Gary Larson Far Side cartoons were. And they found that when people had their mouth in a smile, they were holding the pen with their teeth, they thought these cartoons were funnier. So that this is in most introductory.
That's what all of this is based on? That pencil study in the Far Side? That
yeah.
Sounds like a Far Side cartoon.
Right.
All I can say.
Well, it's been picked up by many other labs since. They've, you know, used either the same pen and mouth paradigm, or they've adjusted it slightly, or they've come up with other ways to get at this, and they keep coming up with the same answer. So, but this study published in 1988 was kind of the first big one that said, yeah, this, you don't even have to know that you're smiling to feel the beneficial effects, one could say, of smiling.
Well, people just seem to love this idea because it seems so simple. To fake it till you make it. This latest study, though, throws a little shade on that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I should say, first of all, that this new study, this was an attempt to recreate that 1988 paper, or one of the studies from it. This wasn't done because anyone was particularly suspicious of that paper. In fact, and importantly, this study was chosen for exactly the opposite reason. So there is this bigger, what's been called the replication crisis in psychology. There's been kind of an anxiety in the field that a lot of classic findings may not be all they're cracked up to be. And so the people, the skeptics in the field a few years ago started to say, well, let's find a really good, reliable study. Let's have someone volunteer their own work who feels really confident about it. And Fritz Strack said, why don't you do my famous pen and mouth study? So that's why they did this to begin with, because they thought it was likely to work. I think that's an important thing here. No one was gunning for this result. And so this study was replicated in more than a dozen different labs in about half a dozen different countries using, if you added all these studies together, thousands of research subjects, and they found zero, no effect at all on the ratings of the funniness of these Gary Larson cartoons.
Maybe it was the cartoons. They didn't stand the test of time.
Right. Well, that's Fritz Strack responded. One of the things he said is, look, in the 1980s, The Far Side was the funniest comic strip around. Now it's whoever who looks at that those cartoons anymore. The fact is, though, that in the new study, they kind of, you know, they pre-tested the cartoons to make sure people found them at least moderately funny. Strack and Martin had actually done the same, I think, in the 80s, made sure that people thought the cartoons were funny. So I personally don't find that very convincing.
Okay, but it's the upshot that it so doesn't work. So if you smile, you're not necessarily going to be happier?
The upshot is that, you know, you talk to scientists enough and the upshot gets very complicated. But the upshot, I think, is this, we can say it this. This original study from 1988, maybe we should be a little bit skeptical of its findings. You know, it's never possible to reproduce the conditions exactly of any experiment. You know, just there's so many variables to control for there. On the other hand, if this effect, with all it was cracked up to be, you'd think it would be easy enough to get something like the same thing by trying as hard as you can to do everything exactly the same. So at the very least, we have to be suspicious of that original finding from 1988, and I think also suspicious of this entire lineage of research that comes after.
Mm, yeah. Well, I mean, it could be something like if you're smiling, other people react to you positively, and that in itself would make you feel better. You're getting positive feedback.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a whole line of studies going back way before the 1980s where researchers found that if you brought people into the lab and told them to smile and asked them how they felt, they said, I feel great, I'm feeling happier. But, you know, there are a lot of different reasons why that might be the case, some of which are more interesting than others. So I would say among the less interesting reasons are that when you tell someone to smile, they kind of, well, what's going to make me smile? Maybe I'll think of something happy or funny that will help me to smile. So, well, that's not that surprising that if you think of something funny, you smile, and then it puts you in a good mood, you're thinking of something funny. So those sorts of things are not really in question. What's in question is this more specific idea that you don't have to be thinking about anything funny or happy. You don't even have to know you're doing it. It's this unconscious mm-hmm. thing. Just the more you smile, the happier you feel. And that's the really powerful idea that leads to these ideas about, you know, well, maybe Botox can get people out of a funk and so forth.
Okay. Read all about it at Slate. There's a lot more there in Daniel Engber's long article. Dan, thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And we want to hear from you. What do you do to feel better fast? Something that's legal, that is. Leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESSPLAY or comment on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, speaking of happy, the comedian David Cross is here. He has a new political comedy special based on a tour he started well before the political conventions.
The sets that I did at the end were quite different than the sets I was doing in April, which were also very different than the sets I was doing at the end of January when I started the tour.
How Cross finds the funny in our current political mess, that's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. David Cross is known as Tobias from Arrested Development and one half of Mr. Show sketch duo Bob Odenkirk, the other half. He's also considered a comedian's comedian, and he's put out his first new stand-up special in 6 years. It's called Making America Great Again.
I'm just talking about sensible, what to me are just obvious sensible measures, like an ID, your thumbprint ID unlocks your gun. You know, like that's like a safety measure. You know, the same kind of safety measure we use to unlock our cell phones.
The show's not all politics, like his impression of Matthew McConaughey accepting the Best Actor Oscar in the year 2042.
All right, 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 all right.
All right, David Cross is here with me in the studio. Hi.
Yeah, that goes on for another 3 minutes. Me wandering around the stage.
That's great. So the name of your special, obviously a play on a certain
Ronald
presidential...
Ronald Reagan's, yeah, Ronald Reagan's campaign back in 80. Yep, we all remember it.
But you taped the special when?
It was in mid-April, I want to say the 20th or something like that, April-ish, uh-huh. Give or take a day.
So he hadn't secured the nomination yet.
No, and it's...
Ronald Reagan.
It's right. It's odd how quickly... When you see how I phrase things and the reaction to it, how it's actually almost quaint now.
Well, you wish, you say, oh, I hope, or something like that. I hope he gets the nomination.
Yeah, but that was back when you could say that, and there was still enough of, well, there's no way he's going to be the Republican nominee, right, guys? Right? That can't happen, right? I taped it right in the middle of the tour. It was a very long, extensive tour, international, and I... finished out the tour with a run in Canada, and he had already gotten the nomination. So the sets that I did at the end were quite different than the sets I was doing in April, which were also very different than the sets I was doing at the end of January when uh-huh. I started the tour. So
when it really wasn't considered a possibility.
Yeah.
Maybe a possibility, but a remote one.
Very
at that
remote,
point.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then was it just more of a funny joke, and as it continued, you got more serious about it?
It's like the serious. It was less me going, "What's wrong, people?" and just sort of, you know, more about like, "Hey, let's be honest here. This there's no mystery as to his success and his appeal because, you know, at least 25% of this country are racist, xenophobic, ignorant people who are appealed to on an emotional level, not an intellectual level, and that's why he's popular. And it was kind of more about that idea.
So how do you do that and say that without offending your audience or a part of your audience?
Well, I don't. I do offend part of my audience. And I'd say roughly 90% of the shows had people walking out, if not more, for various reasons at various points of the show, sometimes very vocally and sometimes not vocally. And then they'd, you know, put something on my Facebook or Instagram or something about how much they hated me. But
is it mainly the Trump stuff that gets them angry or other stuff?
Well, I can tell you when people walk out, but I imagine that they when they're walking out, it's not necessarily the thing I just said. I think it's just the culmination and like, I'm not going to sit through any more of this. Because it starts off, the special's very, it's very benign. It's intentionally so. It's the first 25 minutes maybe. Maybe longer are just goofy, dumb jokes and anecdotes and
you talk about
things.
Spending Thanksgiving with your family.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When you are arguing like that, especially with a family member, and there's no editor, you know, there's no filter. You're just saying stuff back and forth. It's all emotional. And occasionally, in those moments, you will learn something about the other person that you never knew before. And when you find that thing out, it changes the dynamic in your relationship forever. And that's what happened. My mom and I are going at it. It's getting heated, yelling, screaming. Although it's just loud and it's really awkward. And in the middle of this, we find out that my mom cannot take a punch.
And then it gets into the Trump stuff.
You can say what you want about Donald Trump personally. I think he's clantastic. I really do.
And then once it's there, it doesn't, I don't really let up for a half hour. And it goes from Trump to Republicans to, you know, Ayn Rand fans to gun control to religion. And it pretty much stays there until the very, very end where I, you know, I brought it back around with a little Matthew McConaughey thing. Something to wash the taste out of your mouth and leave us all
get
happy.
Get people back on your yeah. side.
So it would be foolish to project onto them exactly why they're leaving, when they're leaving, because I would imagine a lot of it was just like, I'm not going to listen to this anymore. They probably started losing them with the Republicans lacking empathy stuff and just kept losing them.
Do they ever shout anything at you, say anything to
you?
Oh,
yeah, yeah. Oh, yes, very much so. And
can you
again,
not say that on the radio, what they say?
Oh, it's all expletives. And it's one of the most vocal shows where I had a number of people walking out. And, I mean, walking into the aisle, hands extended, flipping bird, both hands flipping a bird, doing circles and talking to me and the audience, you know, just going, you're a f-, just screaming after somebody had thrown their drink. And that was in Northampton, which is one of the most liberal areas. But yeah, I people on the left and the right, certainly. But a lot of people have your back. I mean, you'd have people leaving, but there's kind of a powerful feeling, because I think for a lot of folks outside of the bigger cities, you know, they're in the minority. This idea that I have, the things I'm saying, that's in the minority there. And they're happy for one night, for an hour and a half, a guy came and said these things. And then those people that are leaving, those are their neighbors who are always in the majority. And they, for an hour and a half, they feel emboldened and not so alone. And I think that's where you'd have that feeling.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with David Cross,
the
comedian.
Rewind. Just go ahead and rewind to the beginning. I don't know why somebody would just be joining at this moment.
Just in case they might be listening live. I don't know. He has a new comedy special. It's called Making America Great Again. It's available on Netflix.
Wait, so are we live now? No, we're pretending it's live, right? Because I swore.
We're pretending, yeah.
Is it okay?
Or yeah, we'll bleep it.
Well, then we're clearly not live.
Do you never listen to live radio?
Yeah, I listen to it a lot.
Oh, okay. So you know you can't rewind it.
Yeah, it was a joke.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
All right, let's continue.
Okay, where am I? Where am
Please
I?
Please leave that in. Don't cut that out.
That's going to be left in for sure, because it makes me look dumb. Okay, so I want to know a little bit more about your process, about how you come up with your sketches, how you come up with your...
For a stand-up?
Yeah.
Because they're quite different things, all those different worlds I trade in. But when I'm walking around and seeing things, or things are occurring to me, or I see something funny on the subway or whatever, I have to look at that through stand-up brain.
So everything is absurd? Or absurdity is everywhere, I should say.
I'll take that. I like that idea. Yeah. Absurdity is everywhere. You just need to know where and how to look. Like when I was getting the sets together, I talked about this on stage, and I was coming out of a club in New York at the UCB East, and what turns out to be, I don't want to give away the whole punchline, but the guy who's ranting, who bumps into me or nearly bumps into me, and then I'm hitting the subway, but he's going the same way, and he's just ranting like a lot of people do in New York, and then he's in the middle of his ranting and is swearing at some unknown person. He says "Hi Hitler" a number of times. He's like, "Yeah, okay, Hi Hitler, Hi Hitler." And he looked, he wasn't homeless. That's another thing that I point out. You know, he had a suit on. He was carrying like a tablet and whatever, and he was definitely like, there was nothing wrong per se with him.
And in the middle of venting, he sees Hitler down the street. So he stops to say hi, be a nice neighbor. Either that, or this grown man has lived his entire life thinking the phrase is "Hi, Hitler."
But when you see that, you're like, I'm going to use that. That is gold, comedy gold.
Yeah, I mean, don't say those words too much, you know.
I mean, in your head, you're like,
yeah,
ding, ding, ding. Well,
that was, in particular, that was really funny. And I had to follow the guy, like, there's no way he just said that. And I wanted to make sure. And that's the great thing about New York is, and I take the subway all the time, and I ride my bike, and I take the ferry, and you know, walk for miles a day. And you just, even if you're not interacting, you're seeing it all. You know, and so in that sense, New York is just great for comedy. I mean, there's all kinds of crazy stuff that happens.
Does it restore your faith in humanity in a sense? Because your special, at least when it comes to the politics, is pretty dark. your view of what's happening in our culture, in our society.
Yes, because I'm a realist. Yes. Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's sort of, is it,
it, be, it
does
would
it
be
make
a little
you more
strange.
Optimistic?
Wouldn't it be a little strange for somebody to be like, to have the opposite reaction to what's going on in politics? They're like, this is great. I think this is wonderful. How lucky we are. Yeah, it's pretty dark. There's a feeling I get whenever I'd go away to work somewhere. I'd be in L.A. to shoot, you know, Arrested or whatever it was. I'd go somewhere and shoot a movie or something. And you'd come back to New York, and it doesn't matter if it's 5 in the morning. There's just energy. There's a feeling. There's a and I don't get that really anywhere else. You know, the first New York show, I think, was in April, so like early April. So I'd been on the road for 2.5 months at that point, close to that, all over the country. And man, did I really extra appreciate New York in those moments. And then I went back out, and then I did the Beacon Theater, and I had kind of a similar experience. Like, you know, I just spent 4 days in Florida, and thank God I live in New York. I'm so happy to live in New York.
You know? Let me just ask you this. You were saying that our politics are in a really bad, dark space, and anyone who would pretend otherwise is fooling themselves pretty much.
It has been since around 1812.
Yeah. It's especially this year, though, right? I mean,
yes.
And people are polarized.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever think, well, maybe I'm contributing to this on stage? I'm a public figure. People are going to watch this comedy special.
I don't think I'm changing anybody's minds. I think I'm solidifying some people.
Well, I guess, you know, just the feeling, the atmosphere, the angry divisiveness that we have in our country.
Mm-hmm. But that's also what I do, and I have done it, and I don't mind my anger and the way I'm expressing myself. Because I would inversely say that it's needed because the reprehensible diatribes on you know, by racist, you know, white nationalists or sexist or whatever the people are, that yeah, now I think I should lend my voice to the philosophy that I believe in, because you need another voice to combat all that other stuff. And because I believe in what I say, and I am passionate about like all the stuff that is hard for people to hear, especially in the gun control, specifically in the gun control section, about the NRA, about Sandy Hook, about, you know, I kind of get a little graphic, but I think it's important.
Well, thanks for coming in today.
Oh, sure. My pleasure.
That's David Cross. He has a new stand-up comedy special. It's called Making America Great Again. It's available on Netflix.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brandt. It's Thursday. That means one thing. And one thing only. Shani Jardin is here, co-editor of BoingBoing.net.
Here I come to save the internet.
Well, good luck with that. Let's first talk about saving SpaceX, because their rocket blew up today. What happened?
It's a rough day to be Elon Musk. Not too many days are rough to be Elon Musk, but this is one of them.
Yeah,
so this morning at around just past 9 o'clock Eastern time, a SpaceX rocket exploded on their launch pad at Cape Canaveral. It's not a NASA launch pad. They lease it from the Air Force. But it was during basically a static test, so they weren't moving, but they fired the rockets. And somewhere around that operation, the specifics aren't known yet, it blew up. And this $195 million Israeli satellite payload blew up in the process. As I understand it, part of the point of that satellite, they send these satellites up to go into an orbit that is just in tune with the Earth's rotation mm-hmm. so that it can basically stay in a fixed location.
Right.
The point of that satellite, partly, was to provide internet connectivity for Mark Zuckerberg's big Facebook, we're going to provide bandwidth to people in Africa project.
Oh.
So it's an extension of this project that we've talked about before,
right.
that where he met a lot of opposition in India. People were saying the Facebook is pushing a kind of a closed internet. This isn't really net neutrality. This isn't the open internet. So there were some jokes on the internet today that maybe, well, I won't repeat the jokes. But
well, you can joke because no one was killed or hurt. So
right. No one was killed
good.
Or hurt. And by the way, an interesting thing to think about. So yes, no human beings were harmed that we know of, and the authorities around Cape Canaveral were looking at whether the air quality was dangerous for people or for its workers, and you know it was deemed safe. But you could see on the NASA webcam this giant, giant plume of smoke just kind of going off mm-hmm. into forever shortly after the blast, and there were meteorologists in the area who were tweeting images of the smoke plume, which you could see from space. And then also here was an interesting thing: there was a they described it as a shoebox-sized wad of debris from the explosion was found 1.38 or so miles away.
Wow.
So there was some incredible velocity, incredible violence, incredible force, as you expect when a rocket launches off into space. This was a test. It wasn't the actual launch to put the rocket into orbit, but it didn't go very well.
And it's not the first time it hasn't gone very well. A previous SpaceX rocket has exploded.
Yes. Here's the thing. Space is hard. There's a reason that this is a cliche among people in aerospace. Space is hard. People lose their lives and hardware is lost. This is exploration. This is the final frontier, you know? Stuff's going to go wrong. And an interesting side note to this, who pays the bill? Right? So mm-hmm. they lost like $200 million worth of the client's payload.
Mm-hmm.
That's not SpaceX payload.
Yeah.
Well, space insurance is a thing.
Really?
Right. So that's who covers a big chunk of this bill. You buy insurance. It's like the worst industry to be
yeah,
in.
Who would issue space insurance?
Not very many
like
companies.
A high risk.
Super
endeavor.
High risk. Yeah, because, you know, one launch goes wrong and you lose, well, in this case, just a test fire goes wrong
yeah.
and you lose at least just the payload alone, $200 million. We don't yet know what damage, if any, was done to the launch pad or the launch pad isn't just a slab of concrete out there in the swamp. It is a slab of concrete. I've been there.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to this launch pad, and there are all these crazy little tubes, you know, bringing liquid oxygen and sensors, and it's like the craziest thing. And so if you think about an explosion—
So all that's gone.
We don't know.
Okay.
And here's the other thing. Elon Musk, not exactly the king of transparency. So if this was a NASA cluster bloop— There would be.
Have to know. It's, you know.
How can
us.
I say this? Well, there's just an expected protocol of how they let us know exactly
yeah.
went wrong. SpaceX gets to handle it how they want because it's a private company to some extent.
And they're going to be carrying NASA astronauts up to the International Space Station next year, right?
That's the plan. And they, as I understand it, there was a NASA launch scheduled within the next couple of weeks. So we don't know how this incident will affect the rest of their launch schedule. They have a lot of scheduled launches. But this is, it's just par for the course.
Okay, let's switch gears a little bit. Talk about an internet meme that's making the rounds. And it's a little perplexing to me because it's
right.
based on something that came out in 2013.
Yes.
An article by a guy who makes his living trying to teach other guys how to pick up on women. And this article was how to talk to women with headphones on.
It appeared in The Modern Man, which is a creepy blog for, it's basically like pickup artist, men's rights activist, that spectrum. Ugh. It begins, these days, many women walk around playing with a smartphone or tablet device and are often wearing headphones and listening to music at the same time. Yet, that doesn't mean you can't talk to them. Of course, not all women are open to being approached because not all women are single and looking.
I thought it Ugh. Was a parody, but it's for real.
Madeline, honey, the internet is a strange place. Yes, so...
But why now? As I said, this has been out for, what, 3 years now?
I cannot answer that. But what I can answer is that it did become a thing now. And yeah. This week there were many, many. I actually found out about it because I was reading the very funny tweets that people were hashtagging how to talk with a woman wearing headphones. And the funniest one, I actually made this my Twitter profile picture, is an image of Sigourney Weaver and the alien is menacing her and she has a pair of Apple earbuds in her ears. But there were women and men responding to the ridiculousness of articles like this, there's a lot of this on the internet, which treat women kind of as blow-up dolls that you need to reverse engineer in order to have sex with. And guys, if anybody out there is listening who thinks that an article like this is going to help you find the woman of your dreams or get laid, this is just not how it works. Our answer on Boing Boing, we published a very important response to this, a very important feminist analysis written by one of my male colleagues, how to talk to a woman wearing headphones. Don't.
One word.
Occam's razor, people. Simplest answer is usually the best, even on the internet and in space.
Don't.
Don't.
Okay.
By the way, here we are in the studios.
Wearing headphones.
We're wearing headphones.
Talking to each other.
I'm talking to you. You're talking to me.
This is how you talk to a woman.
But this
with
is
headphones.
A consent-based conversation that we're having.
Thank you. Take note. Do take note. Shani Jordan, co-editor of BoingBoing.net. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Madeline.
Hey, Julie Myers, you're also wearing headphones. I'm going to talk to you. Hi.
That's right. More consent, because consent is important. The other thing that you can do, ladies, if you don't want people to approach you while you're wearing headphones, is you just scowl really hard. Because as we heard, the social science
matter
is complicated when it comes to sculpting your facial structure.
Right. You could be super happy and scowling.
Could. Well, that's I have. I have resting
scowl face.
Horrific. Tragedy face. So
like one of those theater
it.
Masks.
That's
the tragedy
right.
mask.
Yeah, that's exactly yeah. right. That's just what I look like. That's just my face. We talked about lots of things on the show today. Listeners, we want you to engage with us. So go to our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. You can talk about reparations. You can talk about black on black crime. You can talk about headphones. You can talk about drama masks. It's all up to you.
Okay.
The world's wide open.
Do that.
Yeah.
Don't
consent.
Don't
you have
that.
Our consent.
All right. Thank you, Julie Myers, and thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.